and welcome to the ERP Organizational Change Journal podcast, brought to you by Nessel & Associates. Nessel & Associates is an ERP organizational change management firm serving the private equity industry. Hello, I'm your co-host, Jonathan Donald, the founder of Invert Ventures, a change strategy firm, and I'm here with my friend and colleague, Dr. Jack Nessel, the founder of Nessel & Associates, and the host of the ERP Organizational Change Journal podcast. The ERP Organizational Change Journal seeks to share expertise, insight, and create effective conversation to help guide ERP organizational change to real, measurable, and verified success, expanding what we can see so we can act in a more effective way. We seek to promote, connect, and foster relationships in the ERP organizational change community. The primary purpose of this podcast is to discuss, share, and reflect upon effective and efficient ways in which to realize ERP organizational change success. We will discuss the people, process, and technological components of ERP organizational change. This podcast is intended as a forum to study, share, and discuss ERP organizational change. It's our intention for this to be a collaboration tool and resource. We hope that you find this podcast useful as we share lessons learned, discover best practices, and explore the human elements and components of ERP organizational change. Our podcast draws on knowledge from extensive research, collaborative learning, practitioner experience of both project successes and project failures. A general review of the themes of ERP and organizational change practice, literature, and research suggests that understanding and critically having an awareness of tactics founded in principle is fundamental to ERP organizational change success. Our podcast will discuss these tactics, explore these approaches, and discover the principles that they are founded upon so that they may prove to be useful in addressing ERP organizational change challenges and risks.
Thank you, Jonathan. I'm always looking forward to fun conversations with you and our guest. As we are a podcast that desires to engage in valuable insight into the world of ERP organizational change success with interviews and roundtable talk, our guests include experts and pioneers in the field, organizational stakeholders, practitioners, and researchers. We are a discussion on any and all things ERP and organizational change. Our podcast is a platform for those seeking to share, learn, and reflect on ERP organizational change success.
Thank you, Jack. In this episode, Dr. Timo Sandritter joins us to discuss team performance and organizational development. Dr. Timo Sandritter is the Chief People Officer at AllCloud, and he's also the President of RippleWorks, an organization and product that provides a holistic focus on the cognitive, emotional, and physical well-being of an organization's people. Dr. Sandritter is also a strategic advisor for Nessel & Associates with expertise in transitioning to a mixed generational workforce to meet tomorrow's demands and ensure organizational readiness. Dr. Sandritter has a strong track record and expertise in business leadership, organizational development, and strategic planning. Moreover, he is recognized by many organizations for successfully building and retaining high-performance teams across multiple industries and driving the internal capabilities of those organizations. Dr. Sandritter is a serial entrepreneur and co-founder of RippleWorks, a technological-focused software offering that provides professional sports teams, military units, and corporations with a performance accelerator platform. He also holds multiple master's and doctoral degrees, including a postdoctoral fellowship at Harvard University. Dr. Sandritter serves as an adjunct professor at various universities, is a frequent industry speaker, and serves on multiple boards as a director.
In this episode, we will discuss some principles of team performance, organizational development, and business performance intelligence. Dr. Sandritter will explain the valuable notion of how your people are your solution. We will further examine how, by providing a holistic focus of the cognitive, emotional, and physical well-being of your people, unleash their peak performance, quote by Dr. Sandritter. An important aspect of organizational and individual performance is being able to understand and address risk and opportunities. Dr. Sandritter will share his thoughts on how to tactically consider a holistic plan that advocates for individual goals and organizational performance. Dr. Sandritter, thanks for being on our show today.
Hey, thank you for having me.
We really appreciate it. We're looking forward to your experience and expertise and insight. So, Dr. Sandritter, without further ado, let's dive into our questioning. So this is a simple question, but I'm curious as to your thoughts. How would you define, one, team performance, and two, organizational development?
So I think that we have come a long way when it relates to team performance. I mean, for the longest time, we looked at professional sports teams and the way they interact. And often we have team members in those sports team athletes that don't necessarily play in the role that they are best in, but rather in the role that they are best for the team. I think in the organizational context, we are just now looking at this principle of what I call consilience, the unity of knowledge and diversity, of where we allow our team members not only to be at their best, but also in the best of the team. Sure. And so I think we are looking at the team of teams approach, right? And we are... Sure. The principle of 1+1 = 3, as in like together we are much stronger than apart. And so I think the emphasis on the superstar has changed a little bit to the paradigm has shifted to the emphasis on the team.
Right. What a great concept, Dr. Sandritter. 1+1 = 3. That's actually pretty powerful, but simple. So how important is the people aspect of content/technology, people and process in organizational transformation? What's your thoughts on that? So, you know, you have this triad, and I know you're very familiar with this, with people, technology, and process, but how important is the people aspect in terms of organizational transformation?
Well, and I'm a people person, right? So, of course, I have a little bit of a bias. You know, growing up in technology and being in technology for the last 20 years, my passion has always been around the people. I don't ever think that we need machines to replace the people, especially the human touch. However, we've always learned throughout the last few years that technology really helps us. And so I think there's certain components. And one of my professors 20 plus years ago told me that, you know, do what you do best and outsource the rest. And that same principle still stands today when it relates to processes and technology in the application of how we can make the life for humans easier, better, and more efficient.
Sure. So when we talk about people in the context of organizational transformation or organizational change, what do you commonly see as factors that organizations maybe overemphasize or underemphasize in terms of that human element component?
I think one of the common trends is that we simply speak or think out of ignorance. Right. I think we assume a lot as individuals that we, because we do it a certain way, that others should do it the same way as well. And so instead of placing more emphasis on the individual and their associated motivation and growth and skill level, we look at it from an organization first and then try to, I guess, place the individual inside of that instead of the other way around. And
sure.
I think then what happens a lot is you have that expectations minus reality create happiness, and that equation makes sense if it's, yeah, the equation only makes sense, right, if you're realistic with your expectations and the reality.
Yeah, good, great point. So, you know, I know that you focus on the value of cognitive, emotional, and physical well-being of your teams, which is clear just within your answers to the first two questions. Can you elaborate? What do you mean by that exactly? And tactically, how can you actually do that? So, you know, I know we've had conversations before on this idea of cognitive, emotional, and physical well-being and its importance in the context of organizational and team and individual performance. But can you elaborate just a little bit? And then what can we do about it tactically? You know, how do we kind of bridge the gap between, you know, maybe even principle and practice in that regards?
Yeah, I think from the perspective of the organizational context, right? I mean, we are now in an era of course, having a global workforce where cultures and conventions play a role, but we also have a generational gap, right? So we have probably 5 different generations being employed within one organization. And what unites us all of our generations, is probably some software component, probably some platform, whether it's your smartphone, your tablet, or your just computer. And so I think it's important to understand truly the driver of the individual. And so when we look at what we call those hard and soft skills of individuals, the things that they're really, really good at, whether it's on the interpersonal side or simply on the execution side, in the context of what also motivates them, right? And I mentioned that earlier that I think we're all different, and if we can embrace that diversity or consilience, then from the overall perspective, we're much better off. So my driver, whether it's for my organization or myself, is to understand what drives people. You can probably tell by my accent that I'm not a native to the United States. I speak German, right? And I speak German without an accent, fluently, no problem. But as long as I'm also motivated to speak German, it's fine. However, the moment I don't like to speak German, no matter how good I am at speaking German, it doesn't really make sense, right? And so that understanding of what drives me as an individual and what I'm good at in the organization context, I think it's really important, especially when we relate to so many different complexities, such as the generation gap and the conventional and cultural differences.
Yeah, great point. And really to summarize, I think you've really touched on three different ideas there in terms of team and individual and organizational performance. And that is that there are, you know, as you just mentioned, motivational influences and knowledge influences and even organizational influences that may be impacting individual team members, right? And so being aware and cognizant of that and being able to identify what those influences are is significant in individual performance.
Oh, absolutely. I agree.
So I'd like to touch a little bit more on principles and organizational development with the next three or four questions here. And so I want to take a moment to zoom out and discuss principles. And I experience, you as clearly deviated to people as a core organizations and a holistic personal health and development, right? So where did this principle come from? Do you have leaders in the field or core principles that guide your approach?
Originally, I was a lawyer by trade, and I realized that that is not my field of passion. And I've developed a passion simply for the people. Maybe I wasn't smart enough to do anything else. Like, I wasn't that great in math or science. And I wasn't really good at lying. I'm not implying that every lawyer lies. let's call it bluffing. I wasn't really good at bluffing at times. But I always cared for people. And so my father raised me the way to where he told me, Timo, no matter if you own the bathroom or clean the bathroom, you have something to add and you can learn from that person, whether the person owns it. And so I was raised a way that we all can learn from each other, no matter what our status or prestige level is. And so I think that the passion that I've had for people, for many, many years has also driven my technology growth in terms of how I built my companies. I think, you know, at the end of the day, we can debate work-life balances and we can debate our professional life, but we are humans first, right? And yeah. I don't have two lives. I have one life, whether I work or play or, you know, walk on the beach with my wife or I, you know, sit in front of my computer. I don't take one hat off and put another one on. I'm just team at all times. And I think that the more we realize that, you know, we are humans first and then we are XYZ, I think the more we realize that, you know, we only have so many years on this planet, and so let's just make them count.
Yeah, yeah, great point. Well said, Dr. Sandritter. So just to slightly change gears, I just want to get your take on, in terms of personal and organizational development, why is it important to understand risk and opportunities in the context of your area of expertise in personal and organizational development? Any thoughts on risk and opportunities and why that's important to understand? And is there a limit? Well, is there a line?
I mean, this is a fairly loaded question, right? So I can put my lawyer head on and say, well, risk from a component of liabilities or opportunities from a component of, you know, driving the organization forward in the context of, you know, empowering employees. And so to break it down a little bit and just, you know, emphasize on one particular area, I think that the risk itself these days is, hey, can I get my people excited? Do I have to fight for talent? Because there's a war on talent out there, right? And we see that people, you know, in the tech industry have to compete for talent. But then there's also that risk of people leaving my organization if I don't constantly empower them or motivate them. And motivation we talked about generations earlier, motivation has changed a little bit. You know, back in the day, my father was maybe driven by status, prestige, and money. And now, you know, we are more driven by like avocado toast, the 2-hour yoga break. And so that generational difference is different. But I think the opportunity that we have now to setting the organization development in the right context is so much greater because we have more tools than just money, right, to drive organizational development. And so I'm obviously an advocate for organizational development. And even our tool that we built is exactly emphasizing on that, of how we can really develop organization, whether it's from bad to good or from good to great, right? Because there's always a move forward. And I think, and this sounds really harsh and extreme, but you know, innovate or die.
Yeah, that's a very valid point. You know, I think that, you know, I think there's a lot of research that shows that organizations that are able to accept a certain level of risk but also appropriately manage that risk can be more successful at positive organizational change efforts. And in fact, there's this model, it's called the Dennison model. And one of the things they look for is the organization's, you know, position on that, right? What's the temperature in terms of the organization's ability to accept and manage risk? And that's one of the attributes they look for and that they address, because that is significant both from individual stakeholders, but also within organizations. And I think that Dr. Sandritter, you'd mentioned this idea, I think, in the first or second questions about realities and being honest about expectations. ERP organizational change is significant risk. And I think that that idea of risk, but yet being able to turn those into opportunities is a pretty significant idea. Yeah, thanks for your thoughts on that. So the next question we have for you is, you know, understanding that mindsets are causative and that changing them can be a catalyst to behavior and organizational growth is critical, right? I think we agree to that. But how do you make sure that any higher performing change is sustainable and remains resilient? Maybe let's talk about it in the context of tension between viewing organizations as organic versus mechanical systems. It's one thing to get to a point where you're in a process of change and then maybe, you know, your organization gets there, but it's another thing to maintain and sustain that change. So any thoughts in terms of making sure that that change remains sustainable and resilient?
I believe that if you don't constantly transform yourself, at some point you become obsolete. And we as humans, we are creatures of habit, right? So every change, every time the status quo is being challenged, there's an immediate reaction to it. And sometimes the reaction is like positive and sometimes it's negative. And we know that we go from like the innovators to the early adopters to the rest of the people embracing or understanding that change. And I think the organizations just have to make sure they do their homework when it comes to their people, right? There's no one shoe fits it all philosophy in terms of how to prepare the people properly for that change. I think the biggest part that organizations sometimes miss out on is the communication component. It's very easy to communicate change and to embrace change if you're constantly updated on the process of itself, right? But if you do it in like almost like a Band-Aid, you know, ripping it off, you go to your organization and hey, surprise, everybody gets a raise. Even a positive event like that, people start wondering, well, why am I getting a raise? Do I have to work more? Or are they like trying to, you know, get me a different job or more responsibilities? While it's normally associated with something positive, people are resilient towards that change simply because it's our nature. So I think the organization itself has to be mature in its communication, but it's also about transparency. The more transparent one is with the workforce or as an organization, and the more that you make the employee part of the transformation, the easier it is to get their, not just their input, but also their buy-in. And ultimately, we're not trying to change the organization to, you know, make it worse. We're trying to change the organization to move it forward and to embrace that innovation and embrace that transformation from a very open perspective, I think is key.
Yeah, absolutely. Great point. I think transparency, we had a guest on one of our episodes coming up here, and he had mentioned that transparency, this is Tim Van Meegen, and he'd mentioned that transparency is kindness. You know, transparency is leadership. So what a key point, you know, for sure. So Dr. Sandritter, let's shift gears for a moment and discuss a tool that you've developed. And for our listeners, it's called RippleWorks, a business intelligence software and mobile applications. What I'd like to do, Dr. Sandritter, is quote the Huntsville Business Journal for a moment, if I may, because I want to share this with our listeners. And in this article, it said, quote, RippleWorks provides a holistic approach to human performance by analyzing cognitive and physiological data and using machine learning to solve complex problems, such as when athletes are at their peak performance and when they are susceptible to injury. Can you provide a general idea of what you mean by performance business intelligence and how the tool supports that notion of, as you mentioned, discover, enable, impact, and succeed?
I'm gonna make this probably a little bit longer than you want me to be, but I'm gonna explain it and it will make sense. So we look at it as all humans, whether they're professional athletes, whether they're employees, whether they're soldiers, from the perspective of understanding their physical, their emotional, and their cognitive well-being. Right? Mm-hmm. So that's what we are as humans. So the way I sleep, the way I eat, the way I, you know, run my 5K or whatever distance I run, the way I keep in shape also translates to my performance at work a lot of times. Or at the minimum, it transforms to my emotional well-being. So originally, RippleWorks started in the professional sports world where we looked at professional athletes and how to accelerate their performance. So we called ourselves the performance accelerator. Well, in professional sports, it's a lot easier because you can quantify a lot of data. If I tell you, hey, I ran a 5K in 18 minutes, well, at least you have 2 points that make sense. But if I then tell you, hey, my cadence was 170, my heart rate was 130, and so forth, and the elevation of the run was XYZ, now I have a lot more different data sets that I can correlate, and I can understand trends in that. And this, the more data I feed in, like big data, on the vertical level, the more I can correlate on the horizontal level. So we look at it from the perspective of, okay, we're all humans and we're all athletes in all of our world, right? I can be a superstar athlete at work by being an amazing accountant, right? I'm that superstar there. Where if you're an athlete, of course you're an athlete on the field, I get that. And so we looked at it originally from the quantitative viewpoint of the athletes, simply because we had a lot of input that can be measured. But then we also looked at it from the cognitive level for employees. Because, you know, as an employee, you also want to be a superstar. You also want to understand what really drives you forward and when are you at your best. So, you know, if you tell me, hey, Timo, go and take a class on accounting, I mean, I can do that. But as I said earlier, if it doesn't interest me, it's not in my field of motivation, or you don't even measure the impact. You just wasted, I don't know how much it is, $1,500, for example. So understanding not just the data itself, right? We have a slogan that says we don't only analyze the data, we also actionize it.
Yeah.
So we look at a lot of different data sets. And, you know, sometimes people don't want to be measured on how they sleep. And that's fine, right? It's just, you know, okay, less factors to factor in. But we correlate a lot of different data sets for the individual to understand when they're at their best. Like if I know that I sleep 8 hours, I run a 5K, I do some push-ups, and I eat, I don't know, chicken breast, lean chicken breast, then the next day I'm going to have a great day. I'm going to be the superstar in my sales meeting, for example.
Yeah.
And so that's exactly what we do with RippleWorks, really understanding from a holistic approach when we can peak and how we can peak. Like, what do we need to do? That's what I mean by actionize it. Meaning, you know, it's one thing to tell you, hey, surprise, you are going to, you know, you have cancer. Terrible example, but you have cancer. That's terrible, right? But if I tell you, hey, you have cancer, but here are the things that we can do to cure you of that cancer, now it makes a lot more sense. And that's what we are trying to do. Not just tell you where you are, but also things that can make you better. And that's the performance acceleration.
Yeah, absolutely. Very insightful. And, you know, this idea that you're able to discover, enable, impact, and then succeed is, you know, this holistic approach to the person, right? It's not just, you know, 9 to 5. It's just that whole, you know, that whole part of just being human. And one of the things we talked about before, and of course it's very important, right? The more, as you'd mentioned, that you analyze the data, you know, that doesn't really get you anywhere. But if you're able to translate and transform that analysis into impactful action, that's where the change happens, right? That's where the benefit happens. But we've talked before, this idea where this holistic approach that you speak of and this idea of RippleWorks, it's empowering. It creates empowerment when you're able to do that. So I'd like to take a minute. And this next question is really, it's 2 or 3 parts. But can you define your idea of empowerment so that we can get our listeners on the same page? I find it to be one of the most used words that means many things or different things to different people, but can you share with our listeners how you would define empowerment?
You know, for me, empowerment is trust. I think it's very important that when we give people responsibility, that we also give them authority, right? Because otherwise it becomes very dangerous. We just give them more work. So it's that trust in people. And that's what to me is empowerment. If I have to trust that, you know, we say here, there's many ways to skin a cat. And I know that sometimes I would do things very different than some of my peers. And I have an opinion and I can tell them my opinion, but I also have to trust that they will do it based on their best knowledge simply because there's different ways to get there, right? And so you're absolutely right. Employee empowerment has been used for the last 10 years in every other sentence and it's become a buzzword, but how is it really translated? You know, it depends on the organization. So again, for me, it's giving responsibility, but also authority and really trusting the individual to act in the, you know, best interest of the company, even if it differs from our process thinking.
Right. Then now what would you say is the value of empowerment in terms of individual team member development and why? So you defined it, you kind of framed what it means for our listeners, but what is the real value of it in terms of individual team membership, a team organizational development and why? Why is that idea so important?
I mentioned earlier this term called consilience, right? This unity of knowledge. And it was a discussion that I had with another professor at a different school, and we talked about that, right? And then what you can gain from individuals. And so the reason why it's important to empower each other and trust each other is because we all have a different thinking. So my father always said, hey, if you look in the room, you don't want to be in a room with all physicians, or you don't want to be in a room with all bankers or accountants or engineers. You want to be in a room where you have one of each. That way you really come to a holistic solution or a holistic approach. So right. I try to surround myself with a lot of people that think completely different, especially artists. I'm fascinated by artists, right? Because they are like creatives. It's a skill I don't possess. I don't have that creativity. Like when I walk into an empty room,
you and me both.
I see an empty room. But I have friends that can walk into an empty room and they see a lot of different things. And I was like, okay. And so, you know, just learning their perspective, understanding perspective, even if we don't agree with it at all, right? But I think we as individuals can only learn and grow when we look at different perspectives. And so same with this empowerment, right? If we empower our people to act and think, and don't just tell them what to think, but how to think, and then embrace that, I think we become more holistic and we embrace that philosophy of this consilience motion.
Yeah, great point. You know, I think the other thing, you can't really demand empowerment, right? I mean, just like you can't assign ownership, you have to, you know, like you said, there's other, I guess, attributes that come into play where empowerment and ownership is the result. And for instance, trust, right? Or for instance, like you mentioned before, in terms of, you know, you just can't assign ownership. There's knowledge and motivational and organizational influences that might prevent someone from truly taking ownership, right? I think that this idea of empowerment is such a powerful concept.
And, you know, it's like saying, you know, you can't force a company or an individual to be innovative. You can allow for a creative work environment, but you can't just say, hey, Timo, be creative. And I'm going to sit there and I'm like, I don't even know what that means, right? And so you're absolutely right. It's a matter of really just sometimes letting go of control, right? And just letting people do it their way.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So what would you say are some of the key challenges to organizational learning in general? So just to take that step back, it's a pretty general question, but what are your thoughts on some of the key challenges to organizational learning in general? What are some of the key obstacles, some of the key influences, some of the key success factors that promotes or does not promote organizational learning?
Sometimes when you're in this, hey, we've always done it this way mindset, it's very, very challenging, right? And I think it's, and I'm not crediting or blaming one particular industry with that mindset, but I think we've all run into organizations, especially when they're larger in size and they become more complex and they have different, I guess, principles to make happy, whether it's the shareholder or the, you know, the employees, where you have that principle of shareholder value or agent principle theory, and then it becomes a little bit more complicated. And I think often we are in our own way. And there's the saying that, you know, sometimes perfection is the enemy of good, or sometimes great is the perfection as the enemy of good. And so we overanalyze or we overcomplicate things, or we're simply happy with status quo. I think as individuals, we have to understand that this is one life with continuous learning. And so we never really reach the summit, but we have to continue going. And there's some of the organizations that are simply happy. But I do believe that if you only stay in your legacy business, at some point you will die. And we've seen many, many examples throughout the layers, right? I mean, you all know them. I mean, you know, the blockbusters of last century that, you know, they were a decent business, but then somebody else started innovating and they were basically out of business. And that's why I think it's important to really understand from an organizational perspective that we've never really at the end. We constantly have to challenge ourselves, have to challenge our practices and really think outside the box to continue learning and to continue being open and embracing that innovation. And so, I think that the worst, I mean, there's many books that are being written about this, but the worst enemy or the biggest enemy of innovation is really that, hey, we've always done it this way, or we can't do it, right? I tell my people all the time, hey, instead of building walls, build bridges, right? Because once you hit a wall, it's done. And so, but if you build a bridge, you can figure out how, and it drives the organization forward.
Great point. You know, and I think that totally agree that Dr. Sandritter, great points. With organizational learning, I think just to summarize what you said is it comes down to organizational culture, right? It's something that's really driven by the organizational culture. So this idea you'd mentioned of innovation and creativity and shared values is critical to organizational learning. So great points. So Dr. Sandritter, I'd like to switch the last part of our conversation today to questions on leadership. So based on your experience, what would you say are the most important attributes of a leader that wants to promote team performance and organizational development? And if you would, maybe describe each and tell our listeners why. And again, high level, so I'm kind of challenging you and maybe putting you on the spot a little bit. But what would you say are the most important attributes of a leader in order to promote team performance and organizational development?
I honestly think get in the back of the line. I think that, you know, there's so many different, and you know, the topic of leadership has been discussed for so many times. And, you know, to me, even a command and control environment is leadership, right? If you want to be efficient, you can just put the crown on and you can be king of the castle and you can just say, we do this and it's done immediately, executed. Doesn't mean it's perfect, but it works. And then you got this opposite of command and control, and it's this very democratic leadership style where, you know, everybody get a voice kind of stuff. I think from my perspective, I don't look at hierarchies at all, right? I look at ownership area. And so as a leader, I hope I am a leader, I look at my ownership area, and that's why I feel really strong about certain topics, but I also look at other people's and their ownership areas, and it's like a Venn diagram. Sometimes they interact. And then we just have to figure out how to do it together. And otherwise, you know, I do it in my ownership area and you do it in your ownership area. But the principle of that, you know, I'm sitting on a throne while everybody else is working seems crazy to me, right? And I think it seems crazy to most people in this century. Yeah. And so the whole, hey, get back in line, you don't have to do, as a leader, I think you always lead by example. But it doesn't mean that you have to work 70, 80 hours a week, because even that is not positive long-term, right? But it's understanding what a healthy balance looks like. Understanding of how do you set the tone for your culture? Like, what is it that your culture is driven forward? And how do you want that culture to be? You know, I used to use the analogy that we're all different apples in this company. And we all, you know, from Granny Smith to Fiji and I don't know, a whole lot of different apples, but there's a whole bunch of different apples. So even when we hire new employees, you know, it's important that we add another apple and not a banana, because then we got, you know, fruit bowl. But we don't want to be a fruit bowl. We want to be like a nice apple orchard with different apples. And so from the cultural perspective, I think, you know, from in my few years of being in the work environment, I guess it's been 20 plus now, I've always felt that, again, don't ever be too good to take anybody else's opinion into account. Definitely listen and definitely get in line with everybody else and not just, you know, separate yourself because you have a fancy title.
Interesting. You know, Dr. Sandritter, there's, and I think we've discussed this before, there's been a couple, multiple research papers that studied common denominators in leaders was one research. And then another area of research that I'm familiar with was studying educators. What makes good teachers, right? What makes effective teachers? And the common denominator for both of those, and I have to apologize to our listeners because I don't remember the articles at this time, but I can look it up and include it in the podcast references. But it was really interesting because out of multiple works, the common denominator of leadership, whether you're an organizational leader or leading in the sense of an educator as a teacher, was empathy. And I find that to be so powerful. Just one simple little word has such significant meaning and impact on leadership. But I think that, you know, the reason I bring that up is just listening to you and the way that you describe leadership. If I had to summarize what you're saying into a word, that would probably be the word that I distill it down to.
I mean, we can look back, and I think most of us can agree that there's people that were highly intelligent, very, very innovative, that were probably not the best leaders, right? Simply because they were almost too smart for their own good or too innovative for their own good. And I think to understand, and this is only a leadership, right, perspective. This has nothing to do with building a good product even. But from a leadership perspective, to understand that pedagogical skill that often the teachers have, I think even embracing that in the workforce.
Absolutely. So Dr. Sandritter, you know, we just talked about, you know, the attributes of a leader. So if an organization really wants to improve individual team member performance or organizational performance, can you describe for our listeners some examples of tactical actions organizational leadership can take? So, you know, we kind of describe what a good leader is and how they approach leadership. But what are some of the tactical things that organizations can do to promote those ideas?
So now you're opening a big topic. So I think it's fairly well known, and anybody that ever listens to me in any of the podcasts, that I do not believe in performance appraisals, right? For example, I think organizations need to have ongoing feedback culture. You mentioned RippleWorks before, and RippleWorks was built on the ripple effect, right? If you have children, a lot of times you know that you don't wait a year or even half a year to tell your children when they did something good or they did something bad. It doesn't make sense. And there was a book that was written many years ago by Danny Blanchard. It's called The 1 Minute Manager, right? And that philosophy of understanding, hey, when to praise and when to reprimand, I think is a big important part. But it's a conversation. And so I think from this perspective, we even in RippleWorks, we built Ripple to say, hey, you know, we're not called diet works. We're called ripple works because it's a ripple effect. We know that if you don't eat at all for 3 days, you will lose weight. Probably guaranteed, right? Because it's simple calories in, calories out, and what you burn. So you lose weight by not eating for 3 days. But is it sustainable? Probably not. And so it's more about that, creating that ripple effect in organizations that maybe small things that you do over a long period of time create a much, much larger impact. And so things, like I said, eliminating performance appraisals that, you know, no manager wants to give them, no employee wants to receive them. Nobody should wait half a year or a year to get some feedback. Those should be ongoing conversations, one-on-ones, even every week or so forth with employees, where you have a conversation. You talk about the people and, you know, care about your employees beyond just work. Now, that doesn't mean you have to invite them to dinner every night. But, you know, ask them how they're doing and then at least take a break to listen to their answers. I mean, little things. Back a long time ago, 10 years ago, I had an assistant, or it's actually our receptionist, and she asked me, like, Timo, do you not like me? And I was like, why would I not like you? Like, I don't understand. And she's like, well, you walk by, and I say, how are you doing? And you say, good, and you keep on walking. But you don't engage with me. And for me, it was so normal, right? It was not that it was a rhetorical answer, but I was, like, so busy doing stuff. And I paused, and I realized, like, this poor lady thinks I don't – I mean, she thought probably – that I didn't like her for much longer until she actually asked me. So I was like, I never want to create an environment where somebody assumes I don't like him based on my actions. It's a terrible thing. So I apologized to her. I was like, of course I like you. You're great. And I apologize for that. But it's something that I failed as a leader, you know, to take that pause and listen to my employees and listen to their needs. And if their needs are to have a quick conversation about their life, so be it. Those are some of the organizational things that we can do that are so simple. Where I said it at the beginning, you know, we are human first.
Yeah, exactly. And again, Dr. Sandritter, if I had to distill your answer, I'm hearing two things. I'm hearing, once again, this idea of empathy as a leader, but I'm also hearing this idea that's in regards to leader-member exchange theory, which basically says everyone's individuals. And as leaders, you can't apply a template across everybody. You can't treat everybody the same. And so you have to know people, basically what makes them tick, your individual stakeholders and your team members. And sometimes, you know, we deliver the same, I have a message, right? And I want to deliver Dr. Sandritter a message, and I want to deliver 10 other people a message. I can deliver the same message, but I can say it in different ways, right? And I think that's a pretty powerful and effective tool, and it demonstrates empathy. Great insights there. Thank you. So Dr. Sandritter, I'd like to wrap up our interview with one more question for you. And again, it's really kind of a two-part question. You know, this has been a challenging year for many of us in many different ways. And what do you think the new normal look like with that balance between leveraging technology and in-person workforce?
So I think, you know, for RippleWorks, it was a great this situation where we all had to be forced to be in distributed workforces. And we realized that, hey, productivity doesn't necessarily have to go down just because you work from home. Created a great opportunity for Ripple because, you know, we provide exactly that platform. I think what's super important is to continuously be engaged, right? And we want to make sure that we don't feel like we're missing out just because we work from home. I think that we will go back to a hybrid model. I don't think we as human beings, I think we are not meant to simply be isolated and alone. Will it go back to the crazy travel that some of us have had in 2019 or even before that? Probably not, because we do realize that, you know, we can be productive and efficient even when we're not together in the room. But I do believe there's a value of being together in the room. That human touch, I hope, will never get lost, right? And again, you know, I have a platform that helps with all of that stuff. So from my perspective as a business owner, of course I want people to use technology to interact, to engage, and to perform. But on the other hand, I also don't want us to be the generation that doesn't know how to communicate in person anymore, that doesn't value a handshake or a hug or even, you know, the interaction in the same room or having a drink together, you know, whether it's a coffee or an alcoholic beverage or a meal together. I think there's such a high value of being together in the same room that I really hope, and maybe I'm just too old for it otherwise, but I really hope that we don't ever entirely replace that. Because I miss those things. I miss the travel, and I miss interacting with my peers and colleagues in a room and having debates and having heated debates, even that, right? I mean, for us that use, and I got to be careful that I don't miss one, but like Zoom and Microsoft Teams and WebEx and whatever other platform there is, you know, it's great, but you probably realize that if you're in a meeting with 10 people, only 2 people can talk. Right. So if I have something to say to you, the other people just have to wait until I'm done because you can't have multiple discussions at the same time yet. Plus, it's really hard to see a whiteboard. And I know there's more innovative ways these days to have video conferences. But again, we're humans. We need to be together at times, and we need to be able to argue things, and we need to be able to walk around the room and you know, shake each other's hand and so forth.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's finding that right equilibrium between work-life balance, which is important for everybody, and personal engagement. There were a lot of people that would travel one way to work, you know, 1 hour or more, that are now able to work from home, and that gives you more time with your family. And I think that is important for organizations to understand. But then, as you'd mentioned on the other side of that coin, is this idea of personal engagement, you know, to sit on these different platforms and have WebEx meetings or formal meetings, which are just that, they can tend to be pretty formal. You really miss out on the personal aspects of organizational development and teamwork. And that is the water cooler talk or taking someone out to lunch. You know, I think that, you know, building relationships on that personal, professional level with your colleagues is important. So great points, Dr. Sandritter, and it will be interesting to see kind of where that pendulum kind of ends up, you know, after we get through the crazy times that we're in at the moment. Dr. Sandritter, thank you so much for your time today. What a rich and interesting conversation. We appreciate your expertise, experience, and insight. Thank you again, and be well, and we'll talk soon.
Well, thank you for having me, and good luck and best to you guys.
Thank you very much.
We are incredibly excited and grateful to have friends, colleagues, and mentors join us on our podcast. We have an incredible lineup of ERP organizational change speakers, authors, professors, researchers, and pioneers in the field, practitioners, PE partners, business executives, ERP vendors, and organizational stakeholders. Thank you for joining us for today's episode. We invite you to leave us some feedback because we want to make sure this is the most useful and insightful podcast you listen to, and we need your help to do so.
Thank you again, listeners, for being with us this week as we seek to, one, promote, connect, and foster relationships in the ERP organizational change community, two, contribute to the field of ERP organizational change, and 3, bring research and practice closer together. Please join us again next week as we discuss the latest ERP organizational change research, practice, and stories. Our podcast will draw on the knowledge from extensive research, collaborative learning, and practitioner expertise and experience.
From everyone here on the team, Jack, and myself, we wish you a great week, and we hope to see you again soon on another episode.
Hashtag the ERP Organizational Change Journal. Have a fantastic week.
Bye for now.